Previously on Unsolved.
There were some people who said that they saw, like a week before Alexis was taken, that there was this red truck that tried to take a young kid from a playground. That played a factor. The fact that some kids said that they saw an older woman talking to Alexis on the playground. And none of this stuff was like taken, like that should have been like immediate. That should have drawn a lot of attention right then and there. And I don't know why it didn't to the level that it should have.
From USA Today and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved Season 4, A Missing Girl, A Search for Truth. I'm Gina Barton. Chapter 4, A Double Life. One morning, a couple of weeks after Alexis Patterson went missing, a fellow teacher came into Lisa Quinones' classroom. Lisa had been Alexis's preschool teacher for 2 years and considered her almost a member of the family.
One of the other employees came to my classroom and they was like, "Miss Lisa, it's like I hate to give you the bad news, but they found your baby in the garbage can in a dumpster in the alley." And I just told him, "Get out of my room and shut the door and don't come back, because I don't believe it. Until I actually see it, I don't believe it." And come to find out, it was just a rumor. But after that day, I just kept my door closed, unless it was a parent coming in. I didn't want anybody else coming in and saying anything, especially anything that had to do with Alexis.
Not only did that tip and others like it renew the pain for Alexis's loved ones, they sent the police all over the city and the country looking for the little girl. The rumor Lisa Quinones heard probably did have some basis in reality. Steve Spingola, a retired detective who was a supervisor back in 2002, told me the police did consider the possibility that Alexis's body had been dumped in the trash. He said he and other officers searched landfills, but they didn't find anything. That wasn't the only lead that went nowhere. Spingola told me they got dozens and dozens of tips that didn't pan out, some more bizarre than others.
We get a call, check for a suspicious guy in front of Ayana's house, you know, Alexis's house up there. We show up, and he's feeling the waves of death, you know, and he's screaming, and these people are like, "Who the hell is this guy?" I said, "Let me find out." And it was just the weirdest thing. And this guy, he could feel it. You know, he was like kind of like an Ouija board, honest to God, like a human Ouija board. He's walking around. "I feel death. I feel death." I said, "Well, you're going to feel a jail cell if we don't get out of here, because people are like not happy with us, right?"
Police got a tip from a jailhouse informant that they could find Alexis's body in Louisiana. They went down there, but they didn't find anything.
There were calls all over the place. We got calls from like Florida that they saw her. You know, it was just, that's what really kills your investigation. Because unless you got a contact to go down to Florida, and then you go down there and it's like, "Well, what are we looking for?" You know, "Well, somebody claimed they saw her at a gas station." It was like, well.
Ayana remembers almost losing her mind during that time. One of her worst moments was the day she got arrested for getting into a fight.
There was this young lady, she was my sister's friend, and her and my sister had got into it. So she came by my house, and then she stole Alexis's necklace. And then so her and I got into it. And I went to her job, because she said different things, and she stole my daughter's stuff, and I fought her, and we had a fight.
While Ayana was in jail, the woman told the police Alexis was in Chicago with a relative. Ayana says the police kicked in the door of the house and found only her aunt, who was dying of liver cancer at the time. Another one of the tipsters was the woman you heard from at the end of our previous episode.
"I believe I know whose red truck, and law enforcement laughed at me."
The woman is afraid she could become the target of violence or ridicule if she's identified publicly. and she spoke to me on the condition of anonymity. The woman's screen name is Anna Miss, so I'm going to call her Anna. She lives in Cable, Wisconsin, a resort town in the northern part of the state. It's more than 300 miles from Milwaukee. Anna told me she's lived there her whole life. That clip was from the first time I chatted with Anna over the phone. Later, I followed up with her and asked some additional questions.
Cable is a small tourist area. Nobody lives here. And if you do live here, you know your neighbor. You know everybody here. Except for when it's tourist season, then there's a lot of people here and you don't know half of them. We live in the woods. There are zero stoplights. It's woods and lakes.
Anna says she remembers May 3rd, 2002, the day Alexis disappeared, very clearly. Anna was pregnant at the time, and she was driving home from her doctor's office, which was about 40 miles away.
On my way home, there was a black little girl running into the highway. Three cars stopped. I was the middle car, and this white guy comes down and saves this little black girl from running into the highway. I can see both of them. I look directly at them in the eyes, and she looks scared, and he has a smile on his face, and he kisses her, and he sees me, and he waves us all off. And something inside me was like, you need to call the police.
But she didn't.
When I get home, I feel safe. I mean, what are the chances that there's an abducted black little girl in Cable, Wisconsin? I wasn't hearing that there was a missing girl. I just figured somebody is on vacation.
Obviously, I couldn't confirm this because Anna didn't report it to the police. But she did send me a couple of pages from her medical records that showed she had seen her obstetrician that day. The records show that Anna had a blood test done at 1:23 p.m. If someone had snatched Alexis around the time school started, it's plausible that they could have driven more than 300 miles by the time Anna got on the road at 2:30 or 3. When Anna read about Alexis's disappearance sometime later, the detail that stood out to her was the report that a red truck may have been involved. Anna doesn't remember the girl or the man getting out of a vehicle as she drove home from the doctor's office that day in 2002. After the man grabbed the girl, Anna thinks they walked toward a hunting shack on the side of the road. But Anna did know a killer with a red truck, and she started to wonder if he could be the one who took Alexis. Anna was a teenager when she met Eric Robert at the old Telemark Lodge in Cable back in the mid to late 1990s. She was a waitress, and he worked on the grounds.
I knew him as Ranger. Ranger Rick. That was his name. I would just see him in passing, like I said. So he would be in the security guy's office building, which was right where the time clock was when all the employees would walk in and punch in and out. And I would see him there most often. I do remember one time I seen him. We were in the elevator together going up to the kitchen, and it was just kind of creepy. He was the type of guy that made the hair on the back of your neck stand out.
About 10 years later, Eric came to Anna's door on Halloween. She says she doesn't remember the specific year, but she was in her mid-20s.
I remember him coming trick-or-treating to my house. I lived right in town, and he trick-or-treated my house. And he was wearing a hat, just plain street clothes. And I was like, aren't you too old to be trick-or-treating? And jokingly, he said, I'm a serial killer. And I'm like, ha ha, happy Halloween. And I kind of gave him his treat and pushed him out the door.
According to court records and news coverage, Eric Robert did work at the Telemark Lodge from 1994 to 1999, just as Anna remembered. He was living not too far from Cable in a town called Drummond, Wisconsin, when Alexis Patterson disappeared in 2002. And in 2004, he moved to Piedmont, South Dakota, on the eastern slope of the Black Hills. Throughout that time, he drove a red truck. And in 2011, Eric Robert became one of the most infamous murderers in South Dakota. John Holt is a reporter for South Dakota Searchlight. In 2011, he worked at the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, where he covered the case against Eric Robert for the murder of a correctional officer named R.J. Johnson. At the time of the killing, Eric was already in prison for another crime, which I'll tell you about later. John says it's almost as if Eric Robert lived a double life. Back in Wisconsin, he came across as an upstanding public servant. Yet, Officer Johnson's murder was both calculated and brutal.
I was in South Dakota State Penitentiary, which the inmates call the Hill. It's this more than 100-year-old quartzite monolith. That's where he was at. And he got in trouble for attempting to escape at least once, sort of planning that more than once. So he was a maximum security inmate, and he was not supposed to have a job, technically. But somehow or the other, he and Rodney Burgett, who was also a maximum security inmate, managed to convince the supervisors that they ought to have jobs. And those jobs were laundry orderlies. So they kind of wandered around the penitentiary collecting and delivering laundry. And that's how they were able to move freely enough to attack Officer Johnson. It was Officer Johnson's birthday, Ron Johnson's birthday. They called him RJ, and he was apparently well-loved by the staff and the inmates. And he got a call saying, hey, can you cover this shift on his birthday? And he went into work, and he was at Pheasant Land Industries, which is sort of a workshop for the inmates. They make wheelchairs and road signs and things of that nature. And they wandered in, as laundry orderlies are able to do. And they found him. They had a lead pipe and some plastic wrap. They wrapped plastic over his face and beat him to death. And then Eric put on his uniform, and Rodney climbed in a box, and they tried to just walk straight out the west gate, and they got caught. It didn't smell right to the officers at the gate. And Rodney jumped out of the box and started beating on the officer who was manning the gate. Eric helped out, and, you know, other officers showed up and they were aiming weapons at him. And either one or both of them were hollering, go ahead and shoot, when that happened.
This escape attempt and the murder of the prison guard made national news, and it eventually made its way back to Anna in the small town of Cable, Wisconsin. And she suddenly remembered Eric Robert and his red truck and a whole bunch of other things. It definitely freaked her out to hear about the murder. But it was even more unsettling when Anna found out what had landed Eric in prison in the first place: the kidnapping of a teenage girl. John Holt covered that story, too.
Eric was hanging out at some manner of establishment where food and alcoholic beverages were served. He had a few of those beverages, and later on that evening, this is in 2004, he pulled over the teenage server from that restaurant and pretended to be a cop. He had some really bright white lights on the top of his pickup truck, and he flashed them, and apparently it looked enough like a police officer that she pulled over, and he walked up to the window. He said, hey, I'm an officer. We're just checking this out, checking that out. And, you know, he got her to get out of the car and open her trunk. Then he pushed her in the trunk.
Eric jumped into the driver's seat and took off. But he had no idea the woman had a cell phone in her pocket, which she used to call for help from inside the moving car. When Eric realized the police were looking for them, he parked on the side of the road and ran away.
The next day, I believe, really shortly after that, he was found by the cops. And even though when this happened, he was kind of shaggy and he had a beard, when they found him, he was bald and clean shaven. So things looked amiss right away. And, you know, throughout the course of the trial, the prosecutors tried to portray him as a sort of unconvicted sex offender. They said he intended to rape this girl. He had a mattress and a hatchet and some rope and pornography in his truck. And the woman he was working for said, you know, he just slept in his truck so he would not have to pay for motels. So that was his argument, was that, you know, all that stuff was in there because I'm a camper. They called him Ranger in Wisconsin. They would call him Ranger. So that was his argument, but the judge didn't buy it, and he sentenced Eric to 80 years in the penitentiary.
That's the sentence he was serving when he killed the prison guard. Eric Robert pleaded guilty to murder, and he wanted to be executed. But the judge still had a hearing to decide whether to sentence him to death.
That was when we started to hear about what happened, what his life was like in Wisconsin. They dug into a lot of the stuff that happened there, and he was, you know, at least outside the walls of his home or homes, he was a model citizen. He worked in sanitation. He coached Little League. He graduated 18th in his class, Hayward High School. He's a really smart fella. He was an EMT. At one point, he worked to put up a statue of a murdered sheriff who he had never met. And, you know, the people who did know this sheriff were kind of surprised that someone would put that much time in. But he said, I just want to do the right thing.
The judge also heard from two former girlfriends who accused Eric Robert of abuse.
The women in Eric Robert's life, or at least the ones we heard from in court, described a very different guy than the one who the public would see in Wisconsin. The woman he was with for the longest period of time, he built a house with her. He met her in high school. Then they came together again later on. He was, I believe, coaching her son in Little League. That's how they came together. But she talked about, you know, he wanted her to come to bed with no clothes on, and he would beat her up until she submitted to sex. Just about every night, she said, he dragged her around the yard by her hair at one point. She talked about that. She talked about being backhanded for an offhand comment, you know, sort of early on in the relationship, and getting scared. And the relationship went on for years after that. And again, it just escalated. And when he came to South Dakota, he met a woman, I don't know if it was online or what, in South Dakota, and he moved here, and they were looking for apartments in Chamberlain, which is kind of the middle of the state. It's a place where people go fishing and stuff. And she took out a protection order against him because he apparently like tied her to a chair. But he was never charged with that. She didn't want to follow through with charges.
At the end of the hearing, the judge sentenced Eric Robert to death. After his execution in 2012, Anna started putting things together, and she called the authorities.
So I remember calling Milwaukee Police Department and talking to somebody. And I also remember talking to a man named Steve Spingola over email. And kind of both of them told me the same things. And they said that they believed that Alexis was in a landfill, but they couldn't prove it. They found evidence that they can't talk to me about, and I am wrong. And that's all they said to me.
Later on in the conversation, Anna asked me why I thought the police didn't believe her. I think I know the reason. And it's the same reason I've been skeptical about a lot of the things she told me. Anna says the idea that Eric Robert killed Alexis came to her as part of a repressed memory. For those of you who haven't heard the theory of repressed memories, it was popular back in the late 80s and early 90s. Basically, the idea is that people can subconsciously block out traumatic things that have happened to them. And after a time, often years, something triggers the memories to come back into the person's consciousness. Elizabeth Loftus is one of the country's leading experts on repressed memories. She's done studies where she actually implanted fake memories into people's brains, making them believe they'd been saved from drowning or gotten lost in a mall as children, when those things had never happened. Dr. Loftus has also analyzed numerous reports of repressed memories.
Oftentimes, these repressed memories came back through some kind of psychotherapy. So in many of the cases that I analyzed, you would see a patient go into therapy. Maybe she had anxiety or she was depressed or she had an eating disorder. And she'd end up with a therapist who would say something like, you know, almost everyone I've seen with your symptoms was sexually abused as a child. Maybe something like that happened to you. And even when the patient denied that anything had happened in that way, the therapist said, well, why don't we try a little guided imagination or a little hypnosis or some other technique to see if we can't recover repressed memories, because I suspect they're in there somewhere.
As this theory took hold, people started suing relatives they claimed had abused them and even pressed criminal charges. Later, the pendulum swung back. Some of those same people who had been convinced they'd repressed memories of real abuse sued their therapists for planting fake memories and ruining their lives. I asked Dr. Loftus if it was possible for someone to completely forget about a traumatic experience and then remember it later.
Definitely people cannot think about something for a long time and be reminded of it. And you cannot think about a truly upsetting experience for a long time and then be reminded of it. And now you're remembering an accurate memory. And I mean, you just have to go to a high school reunion. You can experience that for yourself. But whether there is some process that's beyond ordinary forgetting and remembering, and that's what's being claimed in these cases, some process beyond ordinary forgetting and remembering that's involved, there just hasn't been credible proof of that, in my opinion.
During my conversations with Anna, she said she didn't think repressed memories could be real either until she started having them. And she told me she remembered lots of other things about Eric Robert, including that he had stalked and raped her. She also said he was a serial killer who had left behind a list of his victims. And Alexis's name was on that list. Dr. Loftus saw that as a red flag.
Yeah, well, this is reminding me of some kind of analogy or metaphors that I've heard in court cases be used in response to a situation like this. You know, if you go into a restaurant and order your favorite beef stew and you know, find a worm in the stew, do you just move the worm aside and figure the rest of it will be just fine? Or do you think, you know, there's something wrong with this stew, I'm going to send it all back?
I, for one, have my doubts about whether repressed memories exist, or if they do, whether they're reliable. And I know those doubts are shared by many in law enforcement. I tried to break that to Anna gently when we talked.
There's so many weird connections here. I have zero idea why law enforcement has not come to talk to me.
Well, I think it's probably because they're suspicious of repressed memories, right? Like, a lot of people think that that's not really a thing.
Yeah.
Right? It's, I mean, like, thing.
Yeah. But how can my repressed memories connect all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think
that's
the thing that I think law enforcement, like, isn't willing to even think about, right?
Yeah. So, he buried something in my backyard, and I think it was her head.
I believe one of my greatest strengths as a journalist is that I'm a good listener. And I have to say, during my time in this business, I have heard a lot of crazy stories that turned out to be true. Like the time we got a tip that Milwaukee police officers were strip searching black men on the side of the road. Or the time a woman told me she had witnessed her ex-husband dismembering a body in the back of a U-Haul truck. The difference is that, in the end, I was able to verify that those things were true. They happened. In this case, Anna didn't have anything to corroborate what she was saying. For example, she said she found part of a skull in her yard, but she threw it away. She said Eric Robert had left a bag of souvenirs in her carport, but she wouldn't tell me what they were because thinking about it upsets her too much. That was the one thing that came through loud and clear during my conversations with her. Anna really is traumatized. It genuinely upset her to tell me these things, but she felt she was doing it for the greater good, to help Alexis's family. Dr. Loftus told me that's not necessarily an indication that the memories were true, only that Anna believed they were true.
I mean, you are not alone in being a human who reacts to an emotional expression and decides, you know, this must have happened because she's so emotional about it. Why would she be emotional if it didn't happen? Richard McNally, a clinical psychologist professor at Harvard, has studied the emotional reactions of people who believe they were abducted by aliens and taken up on spaceships. They're very emotional about those experiences that many people think are almost certainly false memories. So, we know that emotionality is no guarantee that you're dealing with an authentic memory.
Still, when it comes to Eric Robert, a lot of the things Anna told me matched up. The red truck, the nickname, the time he spent at the Telmark Lodge, the fact that he lived in Wisconsin when Alexis disappeared. But despite all that, I was ready to shelve everything she said and not use it at all, because Anna told me so many strange things I couldn't prove. Then, John Holt, the reporter in South Dakota, told me something else.
I did some reporting on this just for you, Gina.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I called his lawyer, or I emailed his lawyer, actually, and I asked about this. And the lawyer said, I vaguely recall Eric saying he had been contacted by a detective in Wisconsin. A Wisconsin detective had contacted him about a kidnapping that took place in Wisconsin.
Yeah. So that made Anna's theory that Eric Robert killed Alexis at least somewhat credible. The police wouldn't bother trying to track it down if they didn't think there was at least some chance it could be true. And there was one more thing. The detective called the lawyer while Eric Robert was still alive. But Anna didn't call in her tip until after he had been executed. Which means the Milwaukee police apparently came up with the theory that Eric Robert could have kidnapped Alexis some other way. But my excitement about this theory didn't last long. Because when the detective asked Eric if he'd been involved in a kidnapping, he said no. And the lawyer didn't see any reason why Eric would have lied about past crimes at that point. He had pleaded guilty to the kidnapping of the waitress. And he'd pleaded guilty to killing the guard. He'd already been sentenced to death, and he wanted to die. So confessing to another crime probably wouldn't have changed anything.
What the lawyer said was that Eric was in a place of reflection at that point in his life, and he was not in a place where he was denying anything negative that he had done.
John also called the former attorney general in South Dakota, who had prosecuted Eric for the guard's killing.
And what he said was, if there had been any credible evidence of a kidnapping, we would have presented it to the judge. And just to sort of hammer that point home, even before I called the attorney general, you know, the idea that there might be a credible allegation of kidnapping that would not be presented at trial is hard to believe for me, because the entire machinery of the criminal justice system in South Dakota was like focused on this guy.
While John thinks it's unlikely Eric was connected to Alexis's disappearance, he didn't close off the possibility entirely.
Now, the one thing I would say, and I might come to regret this, but I'm going to say it anyway. The one thing that stands out in my mind is if he had been involved in something like that and nobody brought it up until after he was sentenced to death and he really did want to die, could he have said, no, I wasn't involved, just because if he'd said yes, it would have delayed his execution? Is that a possibility? Maybe.
14 years after Alexis went missing, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Crocker Stevenson knocked on Ayanna Patterson's door.
And he said, could you just look at something for a minute? And I invited him in. We sat at the round table and he showed me a picture.
It was a photo of a young black woman. After Ayanna had taken a look, Crocker handed her his phone so she could scroll through and see some more.
When I showed her the pictures, she was like, I mean, she was almost didn't want to look at them. She was like, looked at them askance, like just sort of like this. Like, I think she even might have held her hands up like this. And then she said, you know, so she starts looking through the pictures and she said, you know, this, I haven't said this ever before, but this may be my child.
That's next time on Unsolved. Unsolved is written and produced by me, Gina Barton. Ashley Luthern of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel assisted with reporting this season. Our sound engineer is Bill Schultz. Editors are Amy Pyle and Greg Borowski. Our theme music was composed by Evan Johnson. For more on Alexis's case, or to sign up for our newsletter, visit usatoday.com/unsolved. My team's investigation on disparities in missing children's cases can be found at missing.usatoday.com.